This time on Mac Break, are we really getting used to iOS 7 yet, or are the motions causing us to lose our lunch? Why are we seeing so many Apple executives on covers of magazines? They're handsome, but are they really that handsome? And also Bluetooth low energy. Really, really cool, but maybe they're making us a little bit insulated as a culture. All this coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 370, recorded on October 1st, 2013. A simple, humble potter.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MacBreak10.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where everything's made up and the points don't matter. I'm Andy Notko of the Chicago Sun-Times, once again guest hosting for Leo Laporte, who has accepted a gentlemanly wager of £50 that he cannot go circumnavigate around the moon in a dirigible. Good luck to him. We've lost contact him around the Sea of Tranquility. He's on the dark side, the radio blackout area. Those of you who have been following Apollo know. I'm sure things will work out just fine. In the meantime, we do have two wonderful, wonderful people joining us. Oh, I'm sorry. And also, Renee is also traveling. The rumor that he was the person who actually challenged Leo to the wager, and then he felt like he was being shown up that Leo was doing so well, and he set off on his own dirigible to try to beat him to it. I'm no part of that. I love them both. They're both wonderful colleagues, and we'll just hope that they settle it amongst themselves. Let's hope that there's one or both of them still alive next week to host the show. But we got two really great people here. Serenity Caldwell from Macworld. Serenity, how you doing this week?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on, Andy.
And with her in Skype spirit is Dan Morin, also from Macworld. This is a Macworld panel, isn't it?
It's amazing. I'm just so delighted to be here with all of my lovely colleagues.
Exactly. We are colleagues too. So now this is not technically a topic of news, but you're both friends, and so and we can use this as a launching off point. I want to vent a little bit because Apple has done something magnificent this week. All of our lives, we are experienced with individual apps on individual computers, like messing us over. This is the first time I had seen both an iOS app and a macOS app, the same edition, conspiring together to trip me up. So I sent off a bunch of emails on the Mac version of Mac Mail on Thursday. And a lot of these were real, like, people are leaving the office at the end of the week. They need an answer to this, or they need a piece of work from me or something. And so sent off a bunch of emails. I thought it was kind of curious that I wasn't getting replies to those emails, but oh well. It wasn't until Friday afternoon that I realized that desktop mail had encountered a problem contacting my outgoing mail server and decided that I was stressed out enough as it is. Please don't bother Andy by telling him that all of the dozens and dozens and dozens of emails he'd been sending over the past 36 hours, none of them had gone out. So I was not real pleased with Mail.app, but still my expectations have been low. I think we don't have great expectations of Mail.app. Then I found out exactly why it couldn't contact my mail server. And the reason why was because on Tuesday night, I had sent an email from my iPad, from the iPad version of Mail. Something had gone wrong, and it decided to resend that exact same email like 100 times, like within a 5-minute period, and my ISP assumed that I was sending spam from the account. So it was really...
Oh, dear.
It was like in basketball, this would be like in the Olympics, Larry Bird passing to Magic Johnson, swish. Perfect. You gotta really appreciate that kind of attention to detail. So I mean, has anybody here had that same sort of problem? Like, are we giving up on mail now, or should I just realize that this is the mankind is born unto trouble just as surely as the sparks fly upward? Anybody, please.
I have definitely had some problems with mail recently. In fact, on my laptop, which is one of my my primary machines, I had a similar problem where it wouldn't actually send any email. And exactly what happened to you, Andy, where it's like, oh man, people have been really quiet. And I got an email like hours later, like, hey, we really need a reply to this. I'm like, I swear I wrote a reply. Look, there it is in my mailbox. But for some reason, it didn't like my outgoing mail server. I have issues sometimes where I got multiple accounts in mail, and I'll try to send from one account, and it'll try to use the outgoing mail server from another account, and then it will actually send it as though it came from that other account, and it just gets super confused. So yeah, you're not alone in this. And in fact, on my MacBook Air, I've switched to my webmail clients, which is awful because I have three tabs open in my browser now with each of my three webmail accounts. And they're all on different systems, and they're all inconsistent, and I forget to check my mail, and it's a nightmare.
See, that's the other classic problem where you'll have to like resend it from another account, and then for some reason, rather than mail saying, well, for this one occasion, yes, please send it from this other account, it switches you over completely, and now like all my email is being sent from my .Mac account, an account that I only use to prevent other people from having my really, really cool username. And there's the next problem where, wow, now people have like updated their contact databases to send me mail there, this address that I never, ever use.
Mail is, it has some problems. I keep on reflecting on our nice Gmail outage last week, wherein our company currently uses Gmail for everything mail-wise. So for some reason, you know, we had an email gap of about 3 hours due to, I think, a server went offline or something crazy like that. And all of a sudden at about 4 or 5 p.m. my time, I start getting these emails that had been sent at about 9 or 10 in the morning my time. It was just like, meeting in 10 minutes. Meeting changed to this location. Meeting changed to that location. Why are you not at the meeting? Why haven't you answered this really important question? It's, I don't know. Email, you know, email has been very useful for a very long time, and I rely on it in some ways for communicating and getting all my tasks in a row. But honestly, sometimes I just prefer, you know, either human-to-human contact, instant contact via like Twitter or via instant message, or just even messages has been performing lately better than my mail client, which seems a little crazy.
Something.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate. Well, how much do you rely on mail anyway?
Let's go back to telegrams, Andy. That'll be much better.
Carrier pigeons.
We also have the problem where like if we were like potters, let's say, we could say, oh, and someone say, gee, you're supposed to like send me this thing on deadline by yesterday at 4:30. Why didn't you send it? We could say, I'm but a simple and humble potter. Unfortunately, the technology that I'm required to use to communicate with the outside modern world has failed me, and I lack the skills and withal to figure out what had gone wrong and also to repair it. If we use that excuse, even though it's a legitimate reason why we didn't communicate as promised, if you're steadying yourself with a follow-up question. Don't you write about technology? Don't you actually have a focus specifically on this operating system, Andy?
That's what I say every time we try to use Google Hangout for one of our staff meetings. Ugh. And we have to jump through 18,000 hoops. I just point out it's a good thing none of us work in technology. Otherwise, that would be embarrassing.
Yes. Well, you can also get messed up on the other side of the fence. I was working on a video project where me and three other people me and three people who are famous for really knowing their stuff about diagnosing problems with Macs and stuff. We were working together on this project. Suddenly in the office, the Wi-Fi router like goes kaput and everybody leaps into action. It's like a superhero team where everybody has a separate specialty, where I was looking for an update that was necessary to apply to a driver. Another person was doing all kinds of like low level networking hoodoo, looking at packets. Everyone had their own special thing, and it took us 20 minutes collectively for someone to run the cable all the way back to the router and realize that the little tab that locks it in place had broken off. And if we just jab a paperclip in there, it'll probably start. Oh, there it is. Now it's not working again.
MacGyver would have solved that for you in an instant.
And much, much more handsomely, too.
That's true.
But not a whole lot of news this week. So let's talk about some broader topics, though. We're all still getting used to iOS 7. The new iPhones are now out long enough that we're now no longer quite dazzled by the gold color. Now, you guys are kind of in a different boat from most people, and even a different boat from me, because you guys have been working on iOS 7 coverage for Mac World. And how long, Dan, how long have you been using iOS 7?
I rather foolishly installed it on my phone around WWDC. And so, yeah, it had some ups and downs over that period, but that's a solid 3-4 months.
What was it like not getting phone calls or having only 20 minutes of battery life?
Yeah, it was great. You know, it really simplified my life. You know, there were fewer things to deal with, no emails, no phone. It was just, you know, I felt very much a sympathy for Henry David Thoreau. It was nice.
You finally got to catch up on The Wire, which is a show that you totally missed by being productive with your technology.
Read some books. That's good.
Ren, you were working.
Hmm? Yeah, I've been using it pretty much since the same time Dan has. I put the first beta on my phone pretty much as soon as it came out from WWDC because I'm crazy, but also because Mackerel does these things called ebooks and. Generally, we write comprehensive coverage on iOS, and we have to do that basically throughout the 3 months, categorizing, figuring out what's changed, figuring out what gets pulled from the betas at the very last second. So I felt it best, since I was going to be writing so much about it, to sort of be immersed in it. Although I kept it off of my iPad for a long time. It was on my iPhone, and I think not really on my iPad until the GM.
I started using it about a month after WWDC, after I'd finished writing my preview stuff. I seriously did not put it on any production device until GM came out, until the Gold Master. I still haven't put it on my main production iPad because there's one app, Screens, my VNC app, that doesn't work quite well with iOS 7 yet. I think that's going to be my hold off until I put it on the iPad, but it's on my phone now. But so a lot of people are still getting used to the new interface and the new look of pretty much everything. So you guys can give us sort of an advanced look. How much you've been using it for a few months. Most people now have been using it for a couple of weeks. How long did it take you, Dan, before it stopped freaking you out that nothing, all the shapes were different, all the buttons were different, things were sliding and moving, and it was making you feel very, very funny in a very, very weird place?
Well, you know, like so many tech people, I just love things that are shiny. So I think I was dazzled a little bit at first and distracted. And it took probably a couple weeks before I was really feeling as comfortable as I had with the earlier version. It's still, I left my iPad mini on iOS 6 as well, because obviously the beta wasn't available for the iPad at the beginning. And so I was jumping back and forth for a while, which was odd because it was really an issue of, well, okay, I'm going to, you know, use this new, I'm kind of getting used to this. This is new. And then I would jump back to iOS 6 and be like, whoa, what is going on? And oh yeah, this is iOS 6. I remember how to use this. And then you go back to iOS 7 and go, oh my God, what happened? So there was a lot of back and forth there. But once I switched over my larger iPad to iOS 7, just so I could have a comparison point. And I think it really took, you know, it took a week or two. I think it was probably a little bit longer than, say, in Lion, when Apple switched the scrolling direction, which took, I think, 3 or 4 days for me to get, oh, okay, fine. I'm pretty much back to, you know, figuring out how this works. But everything does look different, but everything works more or less the same. And I think that's kind of the saving grace, is it really does feel like, although there's a lot of different, you know, aesthetics and stuff like that, the general mechanics of the OS are pretty much the same. So that helps you feel a little bit more at home. I kind of equated it to going to a strange country where the signs might be in a different language, but you can still sort of figure out, like, okay, that's a stop sign. You know, that's a sign telling me a direction someplace. That's the restroom. You know, I think that's sort of the closest analogy I could come up with.
Hmm. Ren, what was your transition like? Are you now in a sort of a place of peace with iOS 7, or are you accepting it as something that's better, or does it still sort of just register as something that's different?
You know, I actually really enjoyed iOS 7 from day one. I think I was one of the few people who immediately kind of glommed onto the new interface and was just like, wow, this is really awesome. And I mean, I've been wanting some of the features that were present in iOS 7 for many, many years, including things like Control Center. So having that available, even in a very, very buggy format in beta one, was really fantastic. There was a lot of interface decisions that initially I was kind of a little put off by. I felt like the operating system for a while was very sparse and felt kind of, you know, halfway finished. Everything didn't quite gel together. And then, you know, one of the things that I've never really seen Apple do over its beta process is it really did kind of iterate upon those interface decisions over the next couple of betas, which made a huge difference. It changed it from being beta one on my phone looking, being like, well, I'm using it for the great features, but the design isn't exactly where I want it to be, to the GM release, which I still have some, you know, little quibbles here and there. But by and large, like Dan said, going from an iOS 7 device to iOS 6 is kind of horrifying, to the point where I know that iOS 7 is not going to run well on my 4S, which is my testing device, but I kind of want to put it on there anyway because I can't stand looking at iOS 6 anymore. It's too skeuomorphic.
Yeah, I find myself, I'm not quite there yet, but I do find myself when I switch back to my iPad, a lot of like the user interface elements that were so familiar to me, now they kind of look like that unnecessary rear spoiler on like a early 90s like budget sports car. It's like, that's not providing that highlight on that button. It's not providing any downforce. It's not improving the aerodynamics or handling. It's just there because they decided it would look real boss with a spoiler over there. So I think my difficulty with, I don't really have a difficulty with iOS 7. It's more like, it is a very Spartan interface, and it does remind me a lot of what I was designing the first time I got access to tables in HTML. It's, oh, wow, so now I can put this clickable thing in Helvetica on this side, this corner of the screen, and now this clickable thing in Helvetica on this corner of the screen. Oh, you know what would be really look awesome? If I made those clickable things in Helvetica, like, red. There you go. Now they're red. I wish there were a little bit more guidance as a user to try to, there's that sort of visual cue that here is one part of the screen that's in a slightly different color than the rest part of the screen. So if you're looking to tap an action button or find a way to get out of this to go someplace else in the app, here's where you look for that. Here's another place where once you have finished giving the app information that it needs, here's what you tap in order to get to the next step of whatever process you're in. So I think that they've stripped away a lot of those cues out there. I'm also, oddly enough, I find myself still a little bit weirded out by the fact that the hardware bar at the top, you know, that gives you the time, your battery level, and your cell strength is now the exact same color as whatever the top of the screen is. Because to me, that was always a little bit of an extra cue that, oh, by the way, this is special. If you tap this, that will zip you all the way to the top of a scrolling list again. So there's certainly a lot of adaptation. And I think that we're not really going to be done with the iOS 7 transition until all these developers get so much feedback from all of these other users. And they also get all these opportunities to see how other developers had been interpreting this new interface and this new visual guide. And they can pick and choose and say, oh, wow, that's such a great idea. We should use that for the next version of our app. And, oh, wow, did they screw up on that? Weren't we thinking about doing that? Okay, well, we're definitely not going to do that on our app now. There's a really neat article in The Verge a couple days ago that interviewed a couple of iOS 7 developers about the broader issues about bringing a new interface in. The creator Michael Simmons, I'm sorry, I was looking for the name. The guy who created a Fantastical, which is that really great menu bar plugin that I use so much, had a really good point saying that the question was, if all of these really cool visual transitions, all these camera moves, zooming in, zooming out, giving you a sense of spatial awareness of where you're going from one place to another. If those are really great ideas, how come you didn't put that in before iOS 7? Why did you wait until Apple did that? And he said, the answer, if you go too far outside the norm of Apple's built-in apps, the user isn't going to adapt as quickly, and they may reject it for fear of difference, which is a really good point, because if you're the one app that sticks out like a sore thumb, then you look like the oddball. You look like the weirdo. But if you are simply one of 80 kids in the freshman class who are wearing, you know, a propeller beanie, you're not the weirdo. You're just one of these people who's, oh, it's just another one of those guys who wears propeller beanies. Hey, propeller beanies, those are pretty cool. I should pair that with a spinning bow tie, and then I'll look like a big man on campus. I think he's onto something there. Don't you agree, Dan?
Well, there's an interesting issue of vocabulary, I think, is what it comes down to. Is Apple sort of given out this new, okay, this is how we're building apps now. This is the vocabulary we're using in terms of like what a button looks like, what a list looks like, all these sort of building blocks. And I think they're inviting, you know, developers to come up with interesting ways to combine those. I'm very intrigued to see what some people do with it because we've had the thing with iOS 6 was in some ways there was a very fragmented experience. You ended up with apps that were incredibly skeuomorphic. Mimicking real world items. I think, you know, calendar on the iPad, and you know, Find My Friends, Game Center, things that had all these textures and real world applications. And then you had apps that were really very utilitarian, things like Mail and Safari, where it was like, all right, we have a very distinct style that we've been creating, but it's not in something that mimics the real world. It's something that we've designed, you know, in a vocabulary that we believe to be the best way to do things on mobile devices. So iOS 7 has changed that up a bit, and I think they've tried to unify a bit more rather than having those disparate attempts. They instead have said, okay, this is kind of how all of our apps are going to look. We're using these very thin lines. We're using words as buttons in a lot of places. So this is kind of what we're putting out there to going forward. And so what's interesting to me is looking at apps that have taken a really different stylistic approach under iOS 6. And one thing that comes to mind is Tweetbot, which is the Twitter client I use by the guys at Tapbots. And it's a really distinct look. It has its own very particular UI and its own very particular set of design, you know, for how they style buttons and things like that. And it doesn't, it was separate from what iOS 6 did, though it clearly had callbacks to what, you know, iOS was doing at that point. But it's very, very different from what iOS 7 looks like. And so I'm curious to see if they decide, well, you know, our app is so different in some ways, it can kind of live in its own little UI bubble, or if they're really going to feel like we need to adapt in order to, you know, address what Apple's doing with iOS 7. And I think it may be the latter, because we're going to, as you were saying with Michael's quote there, it's a little weird, right? If they exist in this little UI bubble, are people going to be put off when they switch between that and other apps that have more closely hewed to what Apple's trying to do there? So it is... We've only had a few months with iOS 7, and certainly some people have done redesigns in that period, but there's a lot of apps left that haven't yet adopted whatever Apple's doing in iOS 7. So I'm curious to see, as that rolls out, whether we'll see a wider spectrum of apps that have adopted this new design aesthetic.
Yeah. Ren, do you think that's an interesting point? Do you think that it's in the iOS community's best interest that developers start really rallying behind a consistent design language? Or it's great that you have apps that are consistent from point to point, but you know, when you get the first app that comes up with, how about pull to refresh? How about that? Or how about we do away with, you find yourself really liking a certain app, and then you discover that, oh, well, this was originally an Android app, and they decided to simply make a consistent interface between the two of them, and that's why it looks completely different from anything else. Consistency is usually touted as a really fine thing, but is it holding Apple back at all?
I don't think so. You know, I actually think that based on the apps that we've seen so far and the apps that have been released solely for iOS 7, the major developers that have jumped to iOS 7 pretty much right off the bat for launch day, I think Apple is in a really good place in terms of unifying their design scheme without necessarily taking away the individual characteristics from the apps. I mean, you look at apps on Mac OS X, and you're able to do a sort of a wide spectrum of design on OS X, but you still have, you know, the top menu bar, and you have the full screen button, and you have the three, you know, colored buttons for closing or minimizing or enlarging a window. That design, you know, it goes across any app in OS X, and I feel like the vast majority of iOS 7 UI guidelines are very similar. Granted, not everybody likes the idea of just tapping backwards to go on text. And especially when you translate into different languages, it gets to be quite a pain. I know I've seen quite a few reports from international designers who are less than thrilled about that part. But I have faith that the community and Apple, to a certain extent, will figure that out and work on it and get it to a place where it can be. I mean, we've already seen, again, in the beta process, that Apple's been willing to kind of tweak and change its design UI, which is, I think, very different than how they've operated in previous years. And I really hope that the things that designers are having a lot of trouble with, they're basically they're filing radars, they're putting in bugs, they're being like, well, this isn't working. And the people, you know, and I still think that you can hat tip to Apple's design guidelines without necessarily imitating them entirely. I think there are a wide variety of really interesting iOS 7 apps that don't necessarily feel like, oh, minimalist, flat. You know, they still have a lot of character. I'm going to be really interested to see Tweetbot's iOS 7 design. I know it's around the corner pretty soon, and I've seen hints of the icon, and I think that they will do an interesting job, again, hat tipping to iOS 7's design guidelines without necessarily stripping away everything that made Tweetbot energetic and fun in the first place.
Mm. Do you get the idea that maybe also part of this interface is kind of a forward look into hardware that they want to release soon enough, but they can't even hint at right now? Because one of the things that kind of, because I did think that the UI seemed a little bit, I hesitate to say overstripped down, but it really is a long drive in a specific direction, which means that they were really, everyone at Apple on the design team must have really believed in this. And it made me think, well, what are the practical benefits of this sort of interface? And one of the things that came to mind right away is that if you want to really do device screen-independent resolution user interfaces, this is one way to do it. So you don't have, you no longer have button targets that are locked to a certain pixel count. You no longer mm-hmm. have all these elements that are proportion for an iPhone screen or proportion for a specific iPad screen. If it's just text, you can zoom it up, zoom it down, put it wherever you want.
I mean, absolutely.
Yes. I mean, you can overthink it, but.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's actually really, really interesting the way that Apple's chosen to go about that, especially with the new accessibility features and the independent text size and being able to dynamically resize text and Typekit in iOS 7. While I don't necessarily think that they stripped it down specifically so that they could do different devices, I think that it does aid them very much so in branching out iOS 7's basic design schema to other places. I think, again, the beauty that I like about iOS 7 and something that Joni Ive was really trying to emphasize on stage was the layered aspect of the operating system. And I think about it in a way such as, you know, with iOS 7 on the iPhone, you have this many layers. With iOS 7 on, say, a pretend possible smartwatch, you maybe only have like two or three layers. With iOS 7's design schema maybe coming to OS X's next version, maybe after Mavericks, you might have a couple more layers because you're dealing with a more complex system. I think it's a good building block for Apple to sort of base its next generation on and then add and take away features as necessary.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I'm really getting the layering effect, though. I mean, that was certainly a point they made very strongly at WWDC, but it made me think that we were going to see a more obvious layering scheme in the actual OS and actual apps. It really doesn't seem to me as though I'm getting a sense of place via layers of interface. The way that that's happening is with all these big camera movements that they've put into the interface. And that's kind of a point that I realized early on, that I find that I like the user interface when I'm looking at a static screen. I love it when it's in motion, because that really gives you these subtle cues as to, you were here, now you're drilling deeper down over here, and now we're moving you back up a few levels so that you can see all the apps that you've got running at the same time. There is, of course, a story in The Guardian about how all those camera moves are making some people dizzy and nauseated, and not simply on an aesthetic mode. If they have vestibular disorders, which is affecting your balance and inner ear, apparently those are triggers for your condition. I think that's one of the things we're going to have to see earlier, a little bit later on in an update. Accessibility right now, the accessibility options in iOS 7 do allow you to reduce motion a little bit, but I think we're going to have an option to sort of turn those things off, or at least minimize them, because, you know, Or at the very least, if they want to run afoul of the Americans with Disabilities Act, they're going to have to have like two little dots inside the phone. One is a simple moisture sensor. The other one is like a vomit sensor and can see that, okay, well, clearly you're holding the phone up and it was the user interface that made you yak all over the phone. Why don't we give you a freebie on that basis? Great week, though. Great launch week for the new phones. They sold about 9 million, supposedly. Business Week is saying that there's a 9 million iPhone 5S and 5C sold the first weekend. Business Week saying if this single product were its own company in the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, iPhone Incorporated would outsell 474 of those companies, ranking somewhere between Wells Fargo with a $90.5 billion and Marathon Petroleum beating a petroleum company, $84.9 billion, at the iPhone representing $88.4 billion in annualized revenue. Interesting thing, though, is that, of course, it also is outselling all other Apple products combined. And we've all been through like the dark times of Apple. We know that Apple's fortunes can go up. It can go down. Should we be a little bit worried that most of Apple's revenue now most of the revenue is now coming from this one product line, and if the world collectively decides that iPhones are nice, but gee, these other competing phones are pretty good too, half your money off of one product, is that something to worry about, Dan, you think?
I don't know that it's a situation that I would worry about.
I'm not saying Apple is doomed. I'm saying that's sort of interesting.
Andy, say what you mean.
I'm also as a freelancer, I worry about you guys. You work for one company, Macworld. Like if Macworld goes under, you have no income. How are you doing this? Why aren't you freaking out?
I mean, we could be concerned about that since 1984.
Exactly. You've been through those times. Come on, and we lasted. It's certainly a big chunk of it. Obviously, is this a different situation from the 90s when pretty much all of Apple's revenue came from the Mac and that was doing much worse than the iPhone is? I think they've diversified enough. The Mac and the iPad, for example, do very well. I don't think that, Apple might not make as much money were the iPhone to suddenly tank. But it's unlikely that they would just suddenly lose all the sales of the iPhone, right? So it is a lot of eggs to put in a very large basket. But I think the interesting question to look at from there is what comes past this point? Are there other products down the line that might start making up a bigger chunk of Apple's bottom line? The smartphones are still incredibly popular and incredibly, attractive portion of the market. We're still, only 6 years into this whole smartphone revolution, really. And so I think that there's certainly a worry that at some point you might see the smartphone start to peter out a little bit. But I think it's interesting to look at it in comparison to one of Apple's other sort of hot products, which is the iPod. The iPod held notoriously high market share in the digital music arena for many years. But when you look at its overall lifespan, and it's certainly over the last few years started to decline more precipitously, it really only had a solid, 10 years there before it sort of went up and down again. Whereas I think that's interesting to contrast against the Mac, which has now been around for almost 30 years and has certainly had its ups and downs, but it's managed to hold on to a pretty significant niche of the market. And these days it's outselling pretty much everybody else in the PC market. So I think that, while the smartphone might eventually succumb to the same sort of ennui that has hit the iPod, it's going to be a while coming, and it's not necessarily going to be, well, that's because this other product, this other smartphone is taking away from Apple's bottom line. It's going to be because we've moved past smartphones and onto something else. And so it's a question for me, really, of whether Apple is going to be good enough to anticipate whatever that next product line is and figure out how to get in on the ground floor of that the same way that they've managed to do with the iPhone. And obviously, I think the iPad too is an interesting case because you're dealing with something that's very, very similar to a smartphone and yet seems to have its own distinct portion of the market. And so I expect there to be probably an increase in how much of the bottom line is made up from the iPad as well. But they have a lot of products right now and they're diversified enough that I wouldn't be too worried about about that situation.
The fact that you have one product that's making a bajillionized amount of money that's equal to the bajillion you're making off of your entire other product line, that is not a significant problem from a user or a stockholder perspective. But is it, Ren, you think that maybe that there could be a sort of perception problem? I mean, Apple makes so many great products. If they just became, if in 3 years' time they're known as, oh, they're the company that makes the iPhone. I understand they also do laptops, but they're primarily an iPhone company. Could that bite them in the butt?
Well, I think it could if Tim Cook decided tomorrow, oh, we're going to put all of our, you know, all of our talent and all of our work solely on the iPhone. But Apple has never been one of those companies that's, oh, we're only looking at this one project. We're only putting our focus right here. They skate to where the puck is going to be rather than where the puck is. They're putting a lot of effort and a lot of energy into the iPhone for sure. And their sales are a very good reason why. But I think the majesty of the iPhone as a product is that it allows them to play and toy in the same environment that I think they're using to create future products. You know, the iPhone is not just a dead end. It's not just a sprout that kind of peters off and goes nowhere. The iPhone, you know, sprouts into the iPad, could potentially be the basis, you know, the M7 coprocessor in the newest phone. We may see that get used in a smartwatch. We may see some of the iCloud and iTunes improvements that they've made in iOS go to a future version of the Apple TV. Like, I feel like unless Apple's leadership changes and unless their focus on creating the best products for today, tomorrow, and the future changes, I don't necessarily worry that we're going to see Apple sort of pigeonholed and niched.
Yeah, I think it's cool that all the ginchiness of the A7 processor, the new iPhone, not only makes the iPhone cooler, but it also prompts us to speculate if this is we're actually looking at the new processor for the next iteration of the MacBook Air. They really do. They are one company that builds one product line, and that is known as every product that Apple makes. We're going to break for a minute, and we're going to come back and talk about how Apple executives are now airport bookstore poster boys, all over where you can see. But first, let's go to Leo Laporte from in the recent past, talking to us with a message from Audible.
Hey, Andy, please, if you don't mind, I'd like to jump in here. And by the way, Andy, after I'm done with the Audible ad, if you have a pick of an Audible book, something you're listening to, please, throw it in. I'd love to hear about it. But let me just kind of mention audible.com. As everybody knows who listens to this show by now, I am a great Audible fan. Renee is, Andy is. We love audible.com. Alex Lindsay is. I think if you listen to podcasts, you're kind of a natural audible.com customer because it means you already enjoy listening to stuff. But imagine those great books that you loved so much or you haven't read, you've been dying to read. Imagine having them too in your car, at the gym, when you're working out, when you're cleaning house, when you're, you know, just can't hold a book. I was cooking spaghetti last night, spaghetti sauce, chopping up everything, listening to a book. It's just wonderful. I even like to pick the books that go with whatever my activity is. You know, exercise books while I'm at the gym. I love history. I listen to a lot of nonfiction. I listen to a lot of mysteries and thrillers. And the science fiction library at Audible is amazing. You know, they have over 100,000, 150,000 titles at audible.com. So including new stuff when it comes out. There's a new Stephen King, I think, coming out. They've got it. They have all the Stephen Kings, if you're a Stephen King fan. Hey, here's the deal. I'm going to get you a book free. Maybe it's a Stephen King. Maybe it's something Andy's going to talk about in just a minute. maybe it's the book I'm listening to right now, The Denial of Death. It's the one Woody Allen was carrying around in Annie Hall. Whatever. They've got it all. You can get one free. Here's the deal. If you visit audible.com/MacBreak, you'll be signing up for the Gold account. That's a very economical way to use Audible. It's a book, a credit a month. Most books are a credit, so basically a book a month. In addition, though, you get the daily audio edition of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. You pick. And every month, it's fun because you get a new credit and you go, oh, what am I going to listen to this month? But here's the deal. Your first month's free. So if you go to audible.com/MacBreak right now, you sign up for the Gold account, you'll get the credit towards a book. You pay nothing if you, in the first 30 days, cancel at any time in the first 30 days, you pay nothing. The book is always going to be yours to keep. I think you're going to want to stick around. Wonderful stuff. audible.com/MacBreak. In fact, Andy, if you've got a book you're listening to, share it with us, will you?
Thank you, Leo, from the recent past. Actually, this is a book that I've recommended once before. It's Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane. But I'll tell you why. Oftentimes when I recommend a book for these Audible spots, it's a book that I've actually read on Kindle or in paper and have discovered, oh, great, it's an Audible book. I love that book. I'm going to recommend this one. This time I actually had the opportunity to listen to it. And it's Neil Gaiman's narration throughout. And man alive, if he's narrating anything, that's something you should be spending money or using one of your free Audible slots on, because it's something when someone with a voice like that, with performance chops like that, is reading his own material. The other great thing about it is that it's not a terribly long book. It's something like 6 hours, 6 to 8 hours long, and it means that you have the ability to. It's a great thing to be. Yes, 5 hours and 46 minutes, which is roughly how long it took me to do like a certain like Saturday afternoon project around the house, because I kind of start. It's like one of those little projects that you kind of mean to get to, but there are a lot of little steps and just a lot of like meticulous sort of things that needs to be done. And so let's just listen to an audiobook. I'll see how far I get through it. And the next thing I knew, that project that had been standing idle for about 2 months got finished because I'm just listening to this book and I don't want to leave this room with all my tools and the stuff and the project I'm working on, because that would mean like turning off the book. And I want to hear more about this. It's great. So that's it. Ocean at the End of the Lane. Again, anything that that Neil Gaiman is narrating, good pick for you. I was doing a bunch of travel over the past couple of weeks and saw something absolutely amazing at an airport bookstore, which is a row of magazines containing with cover photos of Johnny Ive and Tim Cook and Craig Federighi. And I mean, I actually wound up taking a picture of him, which I didn't share it to you so you can see it. But actually, well, here it is on my vulgar device. But yeah, it's like I can't remember a time when you would see like high level Apple executives giving so many interviews to so many magazines. Certainly not even surrounding a product launch, which. Every other company, when they're trying to get attention for a product, that's how you do it. You give your superstar or well-known CEO get a placement in Time magazine or a magazine that, you know, any magazine that's still being read and enjoyed by a worldwide audience. But Apple has always seemed to be, nope, we will release an iPhone. People will know it. People will know it, love it. The star is the iPhone. We don't need to bring out Steve Jobs. You don't need to bring out Tim Cook. I don't know that it means anything specifically, but that's got to be a data point of some kind, doesn't it, Dan?
I think, you know, I was thinking about this before the show, and I think that what's interesting about it is the audience, right? This is targeted, yeah. To my mind, and it's not targeted at us.
Fast Company and Bloomberg, which are two, of course, business-oriented magazines.
Right, and I think that's a big part of it. I believe Ivan Federighi also talked to USA Today, which is obviously a little bit more consumer-focused, or focused to people who stay at hotels, I guess, because that's the only place I've ever read USA Today. and I think the business angle of it is really important, right? We've had Tim asked several times now about Apple's stock price, which of course took a beating earlier in the year for a perception problem, really. I mean, it's not as though they stopped making money. It's not as though they were not, you know, producing new products and things like that. It's just that people expect them to be at a certain bar, and if they don't hit that level, then they're considered to be doomed or failing or whatever. So I think this is a perception play on the part of Apple to try and say to the, you know, investor types and Wall Street folks that, look, we know what we're doing. Okay, we have a plan. This is not us flailing around trying to come up with something that's new and hip. We have an idea and a vision, and we're executing on that idea and vision. Yeah, you're right. This is not very common for them, and part of that, I mean, that's one reason it works so well when they do it, is that it garners so much attention, because, you know, you can count on, you know, a hand or two the number of times Steve Jobs gave, you know, live TV interviews over the course of his tenure at Apple. But every time that he did, you can be sure that people tuned in and watched. And, you know, even Tim Cook being in a different sort of CEO, but following a similar pattern, whereas, you know, the times that he's actually going to give interviews is people are going to pay attention to that. And I think it's really interesting that they decided to promote these three guys, you know, Federighi, Ive, and Cook, as sort of this interesting triumvirate at the head of Apple, because certainly, you know, in the Jobs era, you didn't see anybody but Jobs as the face of Apple. And I think, you know, we're definitely in the post-Jobs era, and a lot's been made of that, but I think it's important, and they're trying to put out this idea like, look, we're not, yeah, we don't have that one charismatic visionary CEO anymore, but we do have a really good team. And we have a lot of people with their own particular specialties, and we have smart guys who know what they're doing, who are inculcated in a culture of the kind of company that Jobs ran. And it's not as though we're suddenly bereft of all innovation. Here are the guys who are doing the grunt work, and they know what they're doing. And so I think, you know, all of this is a really well-calculated play to sort of put out there that Apple's in good hands, right? Apple's still going to continue innovating. It's still going to continue making great products, and that's their goal.
Hmm. I mean, I did read the interviews, not necessarily expecting anybody to get anything juicy out of any of these people. I can only imagine that they had armed PR people in a circle around the table looking for the slightest twitch from the interviewer that they were about to go seriously, seriously off topic into an area that they're really not supposed to go to. Most of these pieces were all about, here's how we feel at Apple. Here's what we believe at Apple. Here's what we're trying to go for at Apple. And I'm not a business reporter. I mean, do you feel as though that's like a really important thing for them to communicate out there? I mean, shouldn't on some level, shouldn't the products really speak for themselves? If you have to explain the joke, sometimes it's not really a joke.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Dan said in that I think the business community is still obsessed with the fact that Steve Jobs is no longer the head of the company and therefore Apple is doomed. They're not really connecting the idea that, just because Apple's visionary leader isn't at the helm, it doesn't mean that Apple doesn't have scores of interesting products still ready to go. And I think these interviews are very much a way to sort of position these three as, look, as Dan said, the company is in good hands. And if you don't believe us, here is everything we can possibly tell you, which is admittedly not much, but still everything we can possibly tell you about how our company runs, and see how it's very similar to the Steve Jobs era. See how we honor his policies and see how we have these bright young things, Craig Federighi and Joni Ive. Aren't they handsome?
Look,
aren't
trim,
they special?
Young and handsome. But
pretty much, still, right?
But still, with a wisdom of gray hair that makes you think that he's not a flake.
Yep.
It's gray hair, by the way.
That's pretty gray hair.
He's no Chris Breen, but still, you know, that's a pretty good warlock.
Give Chris a run for his money. And believe me, as someone with a little bit follically challenged department, I'm envious.
the other element of that, I suppose, is that there is a lot of concern misplaced from the market, thinking that, well, once Steve Jobs goes, well, that's going to be it, because he was the cobbler who would build every single set of shoes, and he's the one who came up with every single idea, and then he's the guy whose exacting standards guided Apple to excellence. And once you lose that salt from the steak, you've got something very, very tough, dry, and bland left over. So maybe another part of it is to keep those faces out there, to realize that, look, if Joni Ive, God forbid, decides he wants to spend more time with his family, we're not going to be totally host here. We've got two other guys who are also handsome and smart, and if you know that there's, we got time to maneuver. The only thing, it was good to see Apple open up like this. It was good to see them grant access even under these conditions to such high level folks. I did have to sort of temper that, my enthusiasm, by knowing that, you know, I've got lots of old magazines that I've saved of historical interest from the tech world, and I can break out a copy of Business Week where John Sculley is also in the sweater with the Apple logo, with the collar of the shirt underneath, talking about, it's not just about features. It's about creating something that's important, about changing the world one user at a time. And we all kind of know how that worked out, not terribly well. But speaking of Steve Jobs doubt, Harry McCracken, writing in Time in his really great column, was addressing a lot of the commentary that's gone over the past couple of weeks about how a lot of commentators are speaking about how, oh, the 5S isn't innovative enough, it isn't transformative, it's not It's not pivoting the skinny end of the long tail of the hockey stick in a disruptive enough fashion. And he makes a really good argument, which is to say that Apple has not really historically been a company that blows away the entire world with a device that they've never made before and that no one has ever seen before, and making it perfect the first time. They really are an iterative company where it looks like the iPhone is a brand new thing. It is kind of a brand new thing, but it still has a legacy from previous hardware products that came before. And every year they don't have to replace it with a brand new disruptive iPhone. They just have to make the iPhone a little bit better. When I was reading this, I was trying to figure out if the iPad would be the exception to the rule. Do you have an opinion on that, Dan? Is Apple really just doing an iterative cycle on everything they do, or is that just a general sort of thing?
No, I think the iterative cycle is definitely the way that they're structured. John Gruber wrote a great piece about this for us at Macworld several years ago about this is how Apple rolls. You know, they make a thing and then they say, how do we make this better? And a lot of people have that whole thing with Steve Jobs would never have introduced this iPhone 5S. It's too staid. And you look back, well, Steve Jobs also introduced the iPhone 3G and the iPhone 3GS and the iPhone 4, right? Like, you know, there was a lot of iteration in there. It's not every time that the Apple came out on a stage, they said, here's this totally new thing that you're going to be blown away. I mean, the Mac Alopar columnist, the Macworld, does a great job of pointing out that there is the space between Apple's innovations is much larger. Our memory tends to compress those events. But, you know, we had the Mac in 1984. I mean, the next thing that you could really consider a huge revolution in for Apple entering a new product space was the iPod, which was 2001. I mean, that's 17 years later, right? And certainly as time goes by, it seems like those interregnum periods have compressed a little bit. I mean, it was 6 years later after the iPod that they came out with the iPhone, but it was still then 3 years before the iPad came out too. So it's not as though every single time, you know, maybe people are looking at that and plotting it on a graph and saying, well, look, they're doubling their speed. Every 18 months, Apple releases a new innovative product. You know, there's no curve necessarily there. It happens to be whenever, you know, this product is ready to go, I think. So it's a perception issue, as so many things we've discussed today are. But I don't think that, you know, I think Harry did a great job of breaking down what people see versus what the truth of the matter is, that Apple really is a company that creates devices and then works on sort of smoothing down those edges and getting it to a perfect polished point. I mean, a great example of this to my mind is to look at something like the iMac, first introduced in 1998, which in many ways is very, very similar to the original Macintosh from 1984, right? It's the same sort of compact, all-in-one design.
As I recall, it took us all a full day to realize that, oh, wait, there's no floppy drive. We really should have asked them about that because it was such a
surprise.
Random design.
Right. So, yeah, but like in some ways, it was about trade-offs and about packing, you know, sort of what's the future of computing into a box in the same way that the Mac was in 1984. It looked different, and it was updated with the current day's technology at that point. But that's what Apple does. You know, they realize, hey, we worked so long on making these Macs and getting them better and better and better. Let's, you know, iterate on that a little bit and take this idea of what does it mean to have a computing device. And I think almost all of the interesting thread that links the Mac to the iMac to the iPhone to the iPad is this sort of idea of what does this device look like? And you can almost put all of those on a single slope and say, yeah, this is just them sort of figuring out what is the computing device that you need. So, yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah. And also, I think that both fans and bashers of Apple don't understand that Apple is not only iterative within its own company, it's also iterative within the tech industry. I mean, I feel as though if you really want to find out what the next big new Apple product is going to be, look outside of Apple at another product that's kind of successful but hasn't really overrun the world quite yet. And I think that's what they did with the iPad, where they took the netbook, realized that, okay, if people are buying these stupid, crazy, cheap, horrible, slow, unusable computers, that's a lesson we can learn about how people are using mobile computers now, and now we can make one of those but better. And that's why I think that all these talks about Apple doing a watch or a fitness device is right on the money. Not only because, for instance, there is a 9to5 Mac has a piece about how Apple has hired away another person from Nike the former director of essentially their Skunk Works division, Nike's Innovation Kitchen, where they develop new product designs. So yes, okay, more tangible things like that. But even before that, the fact that things like the Fitbit and Nike Fuel are good and popular means that Apple is now looking at, would certainly be looking at that and wondering, how could we do that, only do it in a better way? So I mean, there are companies that, there are commentators who think that Apple invents everything from the forehead of God. And then there are other people who believe that they just are sitting on their own, sitting in their own mire here. But I don't think, I don't think that's a point that's being missed. Where are the new ideas coming from now from Apple?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of fitness tracking. I think is a huge market, and I do believe that Apple sees that. I mean, Tim Cook's been photographed wearing a Fuel band around his wrist multiple times, and I'm honestly surprised that you don't see him pull up his sleeve and he has like one of each kind of tracker, and they're like obsessively studying how can we make this better. But the M7 coprocessor is really, really, it's an interesting addition to the device that I don't think anyone saw coming, despite fitness tracking being so popular. And I think it shows that Apple is really on the ball in that area. Fingerprint sensor in the iPhone 5S is another thing that kind of, you know, people have been rumoring about it for about the last 2 years, ever since that patent application came out. But everybody kind of, you know, rolls their eyes at fingerprint sensors because, oh, it's very, you know, very mid-90s spy technology. And fingerprint sensors can be hacked by gummy bears, right? And no one really uses those. And they're big and clunky. And they just take pictures of your photo in your fingerprint. And Apple's found a way to integrate it into their newest phone that doesn't feel clunky, that doesn't feel annoying, that doesn't make you worried about your security, at least not so much. And it also has the added side effect, you know, it's not super seamless. Like there are still efforts. Like I have an iPhone 5S and I got one on launch day, and I found there are places in there that still definitely need to be iterated upon, but it's so many leagues better than any fingerprint sensor I've ever seen in terms of, especially consumer level, just in terms of simply easily recognizing your print, having a good backup sensor, incorporating it into the OS for things like app purchasing, because God knows most of us have crazy passwords now for our iCloud, and having to tap that in, it's like multiple capital letters and, you know, random symbols, all to try and all in the name of security. To be able to do that just with your fingerprint and to be able to unlock your phone is tremendous. It's a really cool innovation from them. And I wasn't really expecting them to integrate it in quite that way.
Mm. So are you still using it, still relying on it?
Yeah, actually, you know, it took me about a day to really get into it. And to be honest, the thing that forced me, like I was kind of like, I have to not tap in my passcode because it's habit. I've had a passcode since the 3G, you know, or yeah, something like that, where I'm just, you know, I'm like slide, tap, slide, tap. So I set a 25 character password to force myself to basically be like, yes, this is a password that will be very hard for somebody to break in. But it also forces me to be like, oh, right, I can use my fingers. And once I did that, it became almost instant, kind of like, all right, you just tap and hold. And it's so seamless. It makes opening my phone so easy to do, especially in the car. If my navigation has, you know, my lock screen's gone to sleep and you can only see, if you're using maps, like the little tiny square of where your GPS location currently is, I'll just thumbprint it so that I can go immediately to the overview in maps, and I can just, I thumbprint and then I make one tap and then I can see the entire map on my iPhone as my GPS, rather than just that little tiny, you know, 5x5 square of information. So there's a lot of really neat uses. What I was going to say is they still quite haven't got app purchases with the fingerprint down, I think, or maybe they're doing it intentionally that you, when you wake up, you have to enter in your password, your Apple ID naturally, because if you're for some reason your phone goes to sleep and then gets stolen, you don't want to be able to try and hack through that. But in addition, I seem to get, like, I'll get random password requests that can't be thumbprint, that can't be waved aside by the thumbprint. And sometimes I'll get a password request followed by a thumbprint request, which is really odd. I wonder if that's somewhat intentional by Apple, that they actually want you to have a pseudo two-step authentication, but they haven't really made it clear. And that's the one thing that frustrates me. It's like, I wouldn't mind entering both a password and my fingerprint, but I don't know when I'm supposed to and when it's just supposed to be fingerprint. And it's still some bugs to work out, but I'm really liking it.
I think part of it is the importance of reminding people that the thumbprint is not the one level of security inside your phone. You still have to have a good passcode. You still have to keep
you still have to keep
rotating that in and out. I had sort of a weird experience for the first time that I was started using iOS 7 full time on the iPhone, that I found that I could not remember my passcode. Because I'd been using it for about a month. It was down to muscle memory. And so without those square buttons on the iOS 7 passcode, I could not remember it. When you show me round buttons centered in the screens, I suddenly had to sound out in my brain what the numbers actually were. So it's the worst thing that could possibly happen is if you start authenticating biometrically so often that you forget the actual secure method of locking up your phone. Dan, but before we go off that third, Dan, are you using a fingerprint authentication? I'm really curious to see. I'm sure everybody's going to enable it and try it. I'm curious to see how many people will have left it on after about a month. I think it's good enough you could do that. But I'm wondering if, like Ren said, sometimes you're wondering why, wait, I just gave you fingerprint authentication. Why are you asking for my passcode again? It doesn't take too many bad situations for people to say, okay, is there a switch that says, please never annoy me with my fingerprint ever again?
I actually don't have a 5S, so sadly, no passcode for me. I keep pressing my thumb against my iPhone 5, but it doesn't do anything. It just makes me sad.
So sadly. You've borrowed mine, though.
I have used yours, and I used one at the demo area at the iPhone introduction last month. I think it's an interesting idea, and I think it's probably the biggest possible boon for this, I think, is the fact that if you have an iPhone with a fingerprint sensor, you still have to send that passcode, which means that all the people who don't use passcodes will have to enable one if they want to use this cool new WYSI feature. Some might opt not to use it, as you're saying, but I think that a lot of people, the people who want to buy a 5S anyways, that will be part of the impetus behind it is using that fingerprint sensor because it's nifty and it's new. And I think, you know, there have been some really great points about the fingerprint sensor, especially in regards to the people who hacked it. It's very easily hacked. You just need like several hours and the ability to make fake fingerprints. Simple. But the point is,
and hopefully the person you're trying to hack will like willingly like give you nice clear prints.
Yeah, could you just press against this wine glass next time? You know, it's very, very James Bondy.
Let's play thumbprint tic-tac-toe. You start.
Could you just touch this glass pane I happen to have with me? That would be great. Thank you. I think that the great point lots of people made after that event, you know, to sort of calm people down was, look, it's not a question of whether this is, you know, the ultimate most secure way to secure your phone. It's really a question of, is it a good alternative to what most people are doing? And most people are doing nothing. They don't have a passcode, right? And in that sense, the fingerprint, you know, securing your phone with a fingerprint is an immeasurable number of times better because it means that someone still can't just walk up to your phone and swipe to unlock it. And honestly, you know, the idea of that being hacked is not as much a worry as even somebody seeing your passcode, right? Like it's roughly on par. It's easier for them to watch you enter your passcode and see the numbers light up as you tap them in because iOS 7 makes that really easy than it is for them to figure out how to fake your fingerprint, right? And I think, you know, the overall goal is to keep your phone secure because you have so much data on your phone these days that could be used to do nasty things, your emails, your photos, all of that. And I think it's valiant for Apple to try and impose a little bit of revolution in this area in terms of getting people to take, you know, actually at work proactively for their security. And my boss, Jason Snell, made a great argument that's very much like Time Machine was. Backups were complicated and unsexy and all that stuff when you wanted to back up your computer. But so many people lost data because they didn't have a backup. So Apple, you know, decided we're going to make a system that makes it easy. You can argue about whether or not Time Machine accomplished that, but it certainly made people a lot more cognizant of backups. And I think the fingerprint sensor is a great move in the same direction, is it's making people more aware that, okay, I should be securing my phone in some way. And yeah, passcode might be annoying, but maybe a fingerprint sensor is not so bad. So I think it'll catch on, especially next year. It'll be interesting to see how whatever models of iPhone Apple introduce at that point, how widespread the fingerprint sensor is, if it makes it down to sort of a lower cost model of phone. I think that'll be really, really interesting.
Yeah, we do need things to be cool, even when the thing we're being tricked into doing isn't our best interests. I've said before that I didn't really get interested in energy efficient driving until I got this little gadget for my dashboard that now the high score of my MPG is basically the crux of the video game I'm playing every time I get behind the wheel. And so, yes, now I am the loser doing like 64 miles per hour in the right lane of the highway, not going above the speed limit, not because I want to drive safely, because I need to beat 32 miles a gallon. I did 31.5 4 months ago on this run. I know I could do 32. Speaking of cool technologies, there's a couple of bits of news that remind us that probably the next really cool thing component we're going to be seeing over the next year is going to be Bluetooth Low Energy. It's in the Fitbit device. It's that super, super, super critical low power Bluetooth that lets you have this radio going on for just from today until roughly 3 days before the biblical apocalypse, running on one button cell battery. A couple of bits of news. The latest update, apparently, to the Apple TV now lets you configure it by... Now, the reports say by touching an iOS 7 device to it, because it's, you know, how much fun it is to use that little like stick of gum remote to tap in your Wi-Fi passwords and your iTunes accounts and stuff like that. But if you actually look closely, when you set up, there is actually a little thing on the bottom that's saying, oh, if you have an iOS 7 device that's configured, just tap it onto the Apple TV and it will configure itself automatically. It's not actually the tap that does it. It's the fact that your iPhone is now within like 10 inches of the Apple TV that will make that connection and transmogrify all of your data. Another neat bit of information that MLB, Major League Baseball, has a new MLB at the ballpark app. They did a demonstration of what they could do with iBeacons at Major League ballparks. They set up a service like that at Citi Field, the home of the New York Mets, so that when you get off the sub, the way it works, that when you get off the subway, if you launch this app, it knows that, okay, so you've got you're headed for the field. So here's how you get, here's the directions from the subway to the field. Once you are passed by another beacon, like at the entrance, it sees that, okay, it'll activate passbook, get your tickets out, you'll be able to validate your tickets, and then show you, oh, here's where your seat is within the ballpark. And because there are these little super low power location beacons throughout the ballpark, it will guide you exactly to that right place. When it thinks that you could use a couple of beers, it'll direct you to the beer cart. Once you've drunk 10 beers, you'll get a coupon for 4 more beers, because this is baseball and it is a slow game. You need some chemical amusement. It looks really great. It's only a demo they've done for one ballpark. The Mets apparently are thinking about doing it for the 2014 season. I don't know what to think about it, because I like it. I've always loved this idea of iBeacons, which is a feature supported by iOS 7. I wish Apple would be a little bit more forthcoming about how open they intend to be with the technology, because it's one thing to make a ballpark better for people who have iPhones. I would think that they would want to make it better for everybody. And I'm worried about Apple continuing to promote these technologies that are exclusive just to Apple, not only because it leads to a more insular, you know, closed off sort of society, but also that sometimes they don't work as well as something that's open. I had an experience just yesterday, as a matter of fact, where I need to move a photo off of the iPhone 5, 5S onto another device. And because, again, mankind is born unto trouble, just as surely as the sparks fly upward, tethering it to my desktop and synchronizing it over was not going to work well. And I tried to use – I'm sorry. This was – to I will not. I've already started off the show with one comedy of errors of things not going right. I won't go into the second one of why it became important for me to transfer a photo from one phone to another phone. But okay, great. AirDrop, that will work just fine. Oh wait, no, that's an Apple only product. I need to get it off of the Apple product onto this other device, and I could easily move it between any multiples of these mobile devices I have via Bluetooth. Good old fashioned. Low tech, but reliable, open enough that it's built into every device, Bluetooth. And the fact that my iPhone did not have that ability, but every other device I had could. I'm sorry, I should kind of write these things out before I start talking. The problem was that I needed to get individual sample photos, testing the iPhone 5S camera, and for doing so was taking comparison photos with like five different cameras, including the camera phones, including the 5S. I didn't want to have to just tether each one of them and slurp them into Aperture. I just wanted to import each one individually. And because my MacBook supports Bluetooth and all these other phones support Bluetooth, easy peasy, no problem. Air sharing, however, did not work. Didn't work between those two devices. It also would not have worked under anything other than an iPhone to another iPhone at this point. Not until Mavericks comes out. And even so, I was in the airport last week trying to move a picture from the 5S to the 5C that I was testing, and the things are actually touching. Like one hand here, one hand here. It could not connect, even though it could see each other. And once again, this is not a problem I've ever had with Bluetooth. Apple can only improve things Apple feels as though they can improve things the best when they control the entire solution from one end to another. But shouldn't they be a little bit more, shouldn't they join the pool where all the other kids are splashing about instead of having their own little walled off area where they feel as though they can have total control of everything? Aren't they limiting what they can do and what their users can do, Ren?
Well, I don't know. I think that keeping it limited and keeping it together allows them to have more freedom in playing around with the ideas that they're interested in. You know, like with iBeacons is technically an open source technology, or not necessarily open source, but it's technically a Bluetooth technology that enables a lot of, you know, that's been around for the last year or so with Bluetooth 4.0. And Apple is basically just taking advantage of it with a different sort of set of code. When it comes to things like AirDrop, it would be really, really nice to have AirDrop, say, work between your Mac and your phone. But I suspect, I mean, right now, I'm still having problems getting my iPad and my iPhone to connect with AirDrop. I suspect that when they're playing with this combination of Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, they don't have it to where they need to be. And as a result, they don't want to necessarily open it up until they've got it ironclad. We heard, you know, similar sort of ventures of, oh, we're going to make FaceTime open source. And that still hasn't happened. And I have to wonder if part of that is we don't feel like FaceTime is strong enough to exist outside of our platform, and we don't want to launch it broadly and then have it fail miserably, because we've seen how that happens with, say, iCloud.
Yes, sometimes they can control things end to end, and they still make a dog's dinner out of it. Dan, I mean, should we be happy about the introduction of another technology that we can use within the family, but maybe not inviting people outside the family to use it?
It's always a tough proposition, I think, because there is definitely something to that end to end philosophy of we can control all the variables. But at the same time, it can be frustrating, both when that doesn't work because you feel like, oh, it really should work if they can control everything.
Exactly.
And also that
really got me honked off with AirDrop saying, unfortunately, I was in public. If I was inside my office, I would be talking to these things. Here, see each other. You are in proximity. You should be able to talk. You have the same daddy who programmed you.
No talking. But the other half of that is the idea that it is frustrating to have these increasing number of closed systems. And to my mind, a great example of that is iMessage, which is you know, it has its ups and downs, but it works pretty well. And I appreciate the idea that, you know, I can text with my friends and, you know, it doesn't cost me anything because the telco carriers are not, you know, causing me to pay out through my nose for text messages. But at the same time, if I want to text message somebody who's on an Android phone or a Windows phone, and I do have some friends left. I mean, I don't know if I can call them good friends. No, I just have some friends left who are use those platforms. It's frustrating to be like, well, why isn't there a standard? Oh, there is a standard. It's text messaging. But then the cell phone carriers could take advantage of us. So it is annoying to have this fragmentation issue of all these different technologies that don't necessarily talk to each other, especially when they're based on ideas that seem simple enough that they should work. But I don't know. The iBeacon specifically, I haven't certainly seen enough of it yet to know how well that's going to play and whether it's an issue that not having the ability to do that on multiple platforms really runs into problems. But it is also a question of adoption to me. I mean, I think Apple having a technology like this and promulgating it so heavily means it's more attractive because it's one company that can go to Major League Baseball and say, hey, here's this technology we're working on. We really think it'd be cool if we could roll it out and pilot it in this way. Whereas if you're dealing with an open source technology, I feel like in some ways it's harder to get the critical mass you need in order to actually see it adopted. You might see a cool technology and think, oh, this is really nifty, but it doesn't catch on enough because of the platforms that it might be on. And Apple obviously certainly has its own problems adopting technologies that are open and available to many people. So I think that, you know, having a company like Apple that's prominent enough to say, look, we're 100% behind this, we're putting it into every product that we have, makes a convincing argument when they want to go to, you know, Major League Baseball and say, we want to try this out. But it's a little bit harder if it's maybe, you know, Android. If it's a platform that's or it's a third party that comes up and says, we want to make this available on all our platforms, right. You have to really wait to see the buy-in.
It's never going to be a success if a third party promotes it. But you also think about the effects that what a good job Apple did to support Wi-Fi in the early days by when it's certainly a universal standard, but wireless was an interesting thing that they didn't, that the makers, that the world didn't really know what's going to happen with. When Apple went all in and saying, nope, we're going to have, here's our wireless router, here's our wireless notebooks, we are absolutely 100% behind this. I think that sort of encouraged other companies to also buy into it and also make this into the standard that it is. I mean, Wi-Fi is no good unless it is the same standard every coffee shop, every library, every office, every private home that you go into. At the other time, I mean, it's such an interesting calculus because Apple can get iBeacons into malls and into stores and into ballparks and stadiums, partly because they can make the case that, look, we are like an aspirational brand. The people who are coming with iPhones are people who have money, and they are probably going to have money to spend at your place, and they're going to be buying your $8 hot dog and your $14 cup of coffee if you basically make this into a friendly place for iPhone users. So I guess I just want us all to come together and sing and dance around the Mayfair pole and that sort of stuff. I will also, Dan, I mean, I think that we're good friends, but I am also an Android user, but if I'm not one of your close friends, that's fine.
Well, sorry, I never get your iMessages.
That's fine. I haven't heard from you. Oh, that's right.
You're so sad.
How many? This should be the next Tom Hanks, Sally Field movie. if only Nora Ephron were still here to say that, oh, unfortunately, I changed cell phone providers or I changed operating systems. I thought that you had died or you were mad at me. It was just because you were using an insular operating system that doesn't support open standards.
It's because your BlackBerry went out of business.
Co-sponsored by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Oh, that's right. Poor BlackBerry. Oh man, we need to get to our next ad and then to our picks of the week. But we're not even going to make fun of BlackBerry anymore
because it's just a moment of silence.
You have a 40, we could pour out for BlackBerry.
I mean, at least Palm had it was taken out to the back of the shed. The farmer had the shotgun. Palm was told to look out into the field and imagine romping and feeling that cool grass between its paws. And then it was all over with in like one fraction of a second. BlackBerry has just been, the world has essentially taken out to the highway, let it loose in a field, and then driven off. It's not a pleasant thing to look at. We will be back with our picks of the week after Leo has something to say about our friends at Squarespace.
Okay, let me interrupt just a bit. Thank you, Andy. Going to talk a little bit about Squarespace.com. What a great place. If you want to get a website up and running or you want to move your website to somewhere more reliable, more secure, Squarespace is incredible. The all-in-one platform makes it so easy to create a beautiful website. Super pro, super gorgeous. Photographers and artists love it because their portfolios look so good on Squarespace. But you don't have to spend a lot of time, you know, becoming a web expert. You use the Squarespace tools, you get the best hosting and the best software, and you get a site that looks like no one else's. In fact, just visit squarespace.com and you'll get some idea. Pick a template. See that Get Started button? Click that. You'll select a template. There's, I think, 20 new beautiful templates to start with. Every one of them mobile responsive. That means when you resize the screen, it's going to look great. Look on a little tiny iPhone or on a giant 27-inch display. It's always a good-looking site automatically. So pick that template. Start importing your content. You can import it from all the major blog APIs. They have automatic importers. It'll get everything. All your content, all your pictures, all your SEO, your links, all preserved. Even comments get imported. And now you've got a full Squarespace site. Here's the beauty part. You can switch templates. Content is completely separate from template. So you can switch around, try it, play with it. You drag those sliders around. If you're a coder, if you know JavaScript and HTML or CSS, they have a great developer's platform, but you don't have to use that to get a unique, gorgeous site. Import all your social media links. Squarespace is very affordable. Starts at $8 a month with an annual plan. You get a free domain with that annual plan, and they'll hook it all up for you. If you want to do commerce, there is really no better solution for commerce. They don't take a cut. They set you up with a merchant account. I think you use Stripe. It's really a beautiful way to do it. And you get unlimited physical and digital items to sell. They work out. They have taxes. They do that automatically. Shipping. All of this is done for you. It is the best way. If you've got an idea for something you want to sell online, you got to check it out. Squarespace.com. Here's our deal. Try it for free. You don't need a credit card or anything. You get 2 weeks free no matter what. But if you decide to buy, I do ask that you use our offer code MacBreak10 for October, the 10th month, and you'll get 10% off. Get it? MacBreak10 for 10% off. Squarespace.com. Use our offer code MacBreak and the number 10, all one word, to get 10% off. It really is a great place to set up your next website. We love it. We know you will, too. Now back to MacBreak Weekly.
Thank you, Leo, from September 6, 2013. We know that he was alive and well, September 6, 2013. I'm sorry. If you're listening, he had a LCD, like, atomic clock in the background, so you know exactly when he pre-recorded that. I could not help it. As a fan of Columbo, Squarespace, great sponsor, great product. I've heard the ad copy before, so I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, I bet that would be a good payoff for a Columbo episode where the murderer uses that as his alibi, saying, "Well, I couldn't have been in Florida because I was in my studio recording this," and he thought he was so clever because he like changed the date and the time to cover himself. Then Columbo's, "I couldn't help but notice. You also have the phases. That's one of those fancy clocks. Oh, boy, what a wonderful clock. But it also shows you the phases of the moon. I don't know why you think that it was a quarter moon on that date, because according to my friends, it was a half moon. I think that's good evidence, Leo, don't you?" Thank you very much. I also do a President Nixon, and also I do the full suite of 1979 Friars Club roast impersonations.
It's great impersonations.
Out of about that time for picks of the week, Serenity, what is your pick of the week?
Oh, boy. Well, my pick of the week is an app and a service called Loom. It is really, really awesome. I think I talked about its wonders to you, Andy, the last time that we had dinner. I really enjoy it.
I finally got my invite. Yeah, that's great.
That's fantastic. Yeah, so Loom, for people who have never heard of it, is basically a way for you to store all of your photos, whether they're on your iPhone, your iPad, your iPhoto library, random folders on your computer, have them all accessible at high resolution online, and as well as resolution on your iPhone or iPad. So I can browse my entire iPhoto library stored in the cloud and download a high resolution photo from my iPhone. But I don't necessarily see the high resolution photos when I'm just swiping through it. It just delivers the version of the photo that's right for my device. So if I'm viewing it on a non-Retina iPad mini, it delivers like a 2000 by something resolution photo. And then if I'm viewing it on my iPhone, it'll deliver a slightly higher resolution, which is really, really awesome. The apps work really well. The plans are actually fairly reasonable for storing all of your photos. I think I pay something like $50 a year to store, is it 50 or 100 gigabytes, something like that. It's enough to store my entire library, which is fairly comprehensive of photos. And it also supports organization, which is something that, you know, competing services like Everpix has a limited amount of organization that you can do with it. But Everpix is also limited by, you know, only being able to upload JPEGs, and Loom will upload your videos. Loom will upload screenshots. I really dig it. And I think people should give it a try.
Yeah, I mean, I love it, and I'm really grateful you brought it to my attention, because it really is like photo stream, only it's a much better articulation of that idea. If I have a photo, it's there in Loom. I know that I can use it I can access it in a useful way on the device that I have, and so it's just a great service. Dan, what do you have for us today?
Got a game. I am a big fan of board games. I think everybody should be a big fan of board games. And one of the great things I think about the iPad is that it's really well suited as a device for playing and adapting board games into a digital form. And so my pick is a game called Small World, which is made by Days of Wonder, who are the same guys who make Ticket to Ride, which is another excellent adaptation. But Small World is really cool. It's basically a board game. It's a little bit like a, not quite like a Risk, but it has like a territory control aspect to it. But you play as all these different fantasy races. So orcs or goblins or elves or wizards. And you sort of go across the board and you try to claim little areas of territory and take on all these other different races. They just updated within the last, I think it was last month, and they finally added asynchronous online play for multiple people. So this is awesome for me. I've been playing against several of my friends. And so you can do turn-by-turn stuff. You can have multiple players going. You get a little push notification when it's your turn. They've done a great job of building in all the stuff that makes the actual board game so much fun without all the little cardboard tiles and pieces that you invariably lose or have to organize in some way. And it's just a lot of fun, and it has this really neat mechanic, which I like, in which basically you go through multiple races within the course of a game because you put one of your races in decline, which is sort of like that race has sort of died out, but then you come in as a brand new race. And so there's a lot of different strategy. You also have this really cool mix and match aspect where each race comes with a power, and they're two independent things. So every game is slightly different because you end up with a different combination of race and power. And so it changes the strategy so much that there's the games are almost all very, very different. And of course, you can also play against the computer. You can play locally with a pass and play or even on the same device, which is I really enjoy for if you happen to have a few minutes where you're sitting at the airport or something, you can just pull out your iPad and, you know, sit down for the person across from you and just play a game right there. So it's a lot of fun. I enjoy the board game version as well, but this is a more cost-effective version.
How easy is it to jump into it? Like if you haven't played the game before?
I think it's pretty good. I believe they have a built-in tutorial, which we might be seeing a little bit of on the screen right now. It's one of those games that it probably takes a little bit of time to figure out as you're first learning to play, but it's actually not too bad. And I think once you've learned to play it, you know, you can play a game online, I think, in 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So it really is one of those games that, especially if you're playing against a computer, because the computer doesn't spend all that time thinking, where should I go? The computer just goes. So if you you get pretty efficient at it as it goes along.
Excellent. My pick of the week is an app that I use all the time on the Mac. And the version of it for iOS 7 on the iPad is a transformatively much better experience. It's Omni Outliner, which was an early release for the iPad, but it was sort of kneecapped by Apple's kind of casual and casual lack of support for keyboards on the iPad. So if you've used Outliner apps before, you know that you can really blow through taking notes and organizing your thoughts and information as you acquire it simply by tab commands, hoisting things up, making things of daughters of previous subjects. And you can really just, as you go, organize and create a really nicely formatted and presented document. But with the iPad, it really didn't work for me because the iOS 6 and iOS 5 didn't allow you to really have developers to access really the keyboard in any sort of significant way. iOS 7, however, has new support where now developers can add keyboard shortcuts for almost anything that they want to do. So now the exact same keyboard command set that's available on the desktop version of Omni Outliner is also available on the iPad version of it. And yes, if you're using it without a Bluetooth keyboard, it's also just as useful. It's a nice sort of understated interface, interpretation of iOS 7. It's very, very clean, very, very crisp. But for me, as someone who uses the iPad as a main computer when I'm outside the office, I've been waiting for Omni Outliner to get this update for just years and years and years. It is, like many iOS 7 apps, it is a paid upgrade because of limitations of the App Store. But I use Omni Outliner so frequently that I'm kind of almost happy to have an opportunity to give them another 20, 30 bucks every 2 or 3 years. So Omni Outliner for the iPad from the Omni Group. And that is it for this week. Let's say goodbye. And thanks to our guests this week. Dan Morin, you're at Macworld. What's cool, hot, happening with it? And disco-fied for Macworld this week.
Well, of course, we've still got all sorts of continuing coverage of iOS 7 and the brand new iPhones. We'll tell you everything about them that you want to know, including the things that Apple hasn't already told you. And I imagine coming up, we'll have some coverage of those new iMacs that got released last week, along with anything else Apple cares to release this fall.
Yeah, you wrote that with Dan Frakes, didn't you, the upcoming stuff this week?
Yeah, Dan Frakes and I did a rundown of what you might still expect from Apple before the year is out. So,
yep, I was reading that yesterday. Did it come out? It was in my Feedly.
That is good. You must consume everything.
Exactly. Well, I'm a fan. You may be an iPhone user, and I may be a lowly Android user, but still, I appreciate your work. Renity, what are you up to that you'd like to plug to the audience?
Oh, gosh. Well, our iOS 7 upgrade guide is currently out on the iBook store for people who can access iBooks Author, which right now is just the iPad, but the Mac will be coming soon when OS 10 Mavericks is released. And we're going to have that book available for the iPhone and Kindle and your other major devices in the next couple weeks. And we're also just about ready to release our iPhone 5 starter or 5C and 5S starter guide, which is packed full of some fun videos, how-tos, information on how to use and get the most out of your new iPhone, which I've been working on for the last couple months, and so has Dan. So keep an eye out for that on the iBook store.
Cool. I really dig Macworld's iBooks. It's like you see other publishers do books where the content is there and it's perfectly fine, but they're clearly not trying to solve problems. They're trying to work within limitations of iBooks Author. But your books just have a really nice flair and polish that I really appreciate.
Aw, thank you, Andy.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you for listening. Now get back to work because break time is over. Come on, just because the government is shut down doesn't mean that business grinds to a halt.